Here at Central Time, I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, what will tourism look like this summer and beyond as more people get vaccinated? We'll look at the upcoming travel season, and you can tell us where you want to go when you feel safe going there. First, when police officers are accused of wrongdoing, many experts say they can generally count on the so-called blue wall of silence to protect them. It's a term used to describe an unofficial agreement between officers not to report a colleague's transgressions. But many are breaking with that unofficial code to condemn the actions of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who's on trial for the death of George Floyd, who died after Chauvin held his knee on Floyd's neck. On the witness stand last week, Minneapolis Police Chief Madaria Arredondo said that Chauvin's restraint of Floyd should have ended when Floyd stopped resisting arrest and when he tried to verbalize that he was in distress.
To continue to apply that level of force to a person proned out, handcuffed behind their back, that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the trial of Derek Chauvin? What has stuck out to you about the way his colleagues, leading law enforcement officers, are speaking about him? Do you think this marks any kind of turning point in how law enforcement grapples with issues of wrongdoing, or do you think it's an isolated incident? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Philip Stinson is an assistant professor in the Criminal Justice Program in the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University. He's a former police officer and attorney. He created one of the country's most comprehensive data sets on police misconduct. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Good to be with you.
Before we get into the particulars of the trial of Derek Chauvin, Phil, I want to ask about this concept of the blue wall of silence. I think at least in popular perception, it exists. Is it a reality in police forces, do you think?
Well, it's certainly something that's been written about in the policing scholarship really for the last 100 years or so. Going back to the early 1930s, we can find scholarship that talks about this. More recently, the prevalent view is that the blue wall of the more than 18,000 state and local law enforcement agencies across the country. What I've seen over the last decade or so, though, in my research. So I study police crime. We look at non-federal sworn law enforcement officers who were arrested for anything. It could be drunk driving, murder, and everything in between, on-duty or off-duty crimes. And I've studied this for almost 17 years now, back since 2005 or so. And in my research, what I've seen is that there are some things that fellow officers are simply not willing to cover for. There are some things that are simply so egregious, so over the top, lacking in any rational explanation at all in terms of police behaviors, that that an officer's peers simply will not cover for them. And that's often the case with fatal shootings by police officers and other in-custody deaths, if you will, where we see that other officers come forward. Oftentimes it's in the case of on-duty shootings where the legal standard is that an officer is legally justified in using deadly force if the officer has a reasonable apprehension of an imminent threat of serious bodily injury or death being imposed against the officer or someone else. And the Supreme Court has said that that's a standard of objective reasonableness. In other words, what a reasonable police officer on the scene without the benefit of hindsight would have perceived. So the first place that investigators and prosecutors go is to talk to other officers on the scene. And what we've seen is that in these types of cases where they're just egregious incidents, we find that other officers on the scene tell it like it is. And if they don't think that they perceive the threat, they're going to say so. And that seems to be the exception or the times where other officers will come forward. And then we've seen that in this case as well, where you have the police chief and everybody on down who's testifying in this case for the behalf of the prosecution.
Looking at this case in particular now, we see, as you say, the police chief, others, police experts from other agencies around the country being very willing to speak critically of this officer on trial. He and other officers on the scene were fired, I think, the day after George Floyd's death. Does this, do you think, fit into that category of egregious misconduct that you were just talking about a moment ago, where that that's going to overcome that maybe initial blue wall of silence?
I think it's egregious, absolutely. But I also think that this case, the Derek Chauvin prosecution, is an outlier. It's a show trial. Everybody's paying attention. It's not just a local or regional news event. It's a national, international news event on a daily basis for weeks on end as we see this trial, which will probably extend out over a month long. So it's an outlier. It's an unusual case. It's a show trial. I don't think that it really suggests that there's a tidal change, that we're seeing, a breaking down of that blue wall of silence, that the code of silence is disappearing. What we really need to focus on in terms of police reforms are changing police behaviors, changing the police subculture, because all the policies can be changed. Reforms can be legislated from state capitals and from Washington, D.C., but unless we change the behaviors and the socialization process, the cultural processes at work within law enforcement agencies, I don't think we can make meaningful change systemically going forward.
Talking to Philip Stinson, professor in the criminal justice program at Bowling Green State University, also a former police officer, looking at the idea of a blue wall of silence when police officers are or aren't, in some cases, willing to testify against one another. The Derek Chauvin trial in Minneapolis, an example where clearly many in the police department in Minneapolis and beyond willing to testify against the former officer. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Robert is with us in Stevens Point. Robert, hello.
Hi. First thing of all, I think that police officers are indoctrinated with a thought process that they are better than others. And that proves a very big problem, because when you think you're better than your human man, your co-person living in the world, it's not conducive to you being having any empathy or support for each other or having any thought concept about what that person's life is, because that person is a live being. You are a live being as a police officer. They should know better. And I think the way they could correct it is they could have send them back to school, send them back to training, and, you know, bit by bit, and teach them that these are not acceptable ways to treat people. And that by retraining them and reprogramming them, you might have a chance.
Robert, can I ask, have you had experience on either side of law enforcement?
Yes, I have. And I will tell you that when you get police officers and you get district attorneys involved and they're all out there hanging out, they don't care about you at all. They don't care. They care about themselves and what they're doing. And to sit there and say, oh, well, it's just one bad apple. No, I'm sorry to tell you, that tree is rotten. They need to really do something about the police.
Robert, thanks for the call. And Phil, Robert, I think speaking some to that culture change you were just talking about, what do you hear from what Robert said there?
Right. Well, thank you, Robert, for your comments. I do think that police officers are socialized early in their career as recruits into an us versus them world where it's police officers and everybody else. And oftentimes with this warrior mentality, it soon becomes everybody else is an enemy. So I think Robert makes some good points there. I do worry, though, as to whether we can train our way out of it. You know, an hour or two or half a day's implicit bias training every year, I don't know that that can really change, as Robert called, thought processes, behaviors of police officers. I tend to agree with Robert that it's not just a few bad apples. Now, I want to be careful with that because there are many good police officers, and I don't want to suggest otherwise. However, I think we've seen enough of these cases, even though this case, the Chauvin case, is an outlier, as I said earlier. I think we're dealing more than a few bad apples. The problem with the bad apples theory is that a police chief or a mayor can say, well, we had a bad apple here. We got rid of the bad apple and everything's okay. The police department can move forward now. And I think that's been disproven certainly as far back as the Knapp Commission in the early 1970s and the Mullen Commission in the 1990s in New York City. It's more systemic than that at many agencies across the country. And we really need to rethink not only what it is we want police officers to be doing as their jobs and their core functions, but what type of people do we want to be police officers?
But thanks a lot for that call, Robert. Given the nature of the job, Phil, it is stressful. It is clearly sometimes dangerous. Police officers want to know that their fellow officers have their back. It kind of invites us seeing that kind of loyalty as a virtue, and maybe it can almost lead naturally to that us versus them mentality. If it takes more than just a little bit of training here and there, what is it going to take to not have that, what you call it, us versus them mentality?
Well, one of the problems that I see, you know, a lot of people talk about institutional racism, and I want to break it down even further. I think that many people, many police officers, I think that many police officers, not all, but many police officers have a fear of Black people, and more often than not, Black males. And we see that time and again. And somehow we've got to rethink all of this. We've got to make sure that our police officers are from and of and about the communities in which they serve, in which they work on a daily basis, that they aren't living in completely different ways where they're coming in a quasi-military organization to go to war every day to fight crime. We've got to rethink all of this. And until we do that, I don't think we can get away from these problems.
We're talking about the Derek Chauvin trial and the so-called Blue Wall of Silence with Philip Stinson. He's a professor in the Criminal Justice Program in the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University. He's a former police officer himself and attorney. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Derek Chauvin trial will change law enforcement in any way? If so, how? What do you make of the fact that many police officers, many of the former officers' superiors testifying that they do think he went outside of his training, misused force in the case of George Floyd? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Phil Stinson, professor in the Criminal Justice Program in the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University, former police officer. We're talking to him about how uncommon it is for police officers to speak out against their colleagues and how we are seeing that happen, some during the Derek Chauvin trial. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a current or former police officer? What have you been thinking about during the trial of Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd? Do you think there's something missing from the conversation when we talk about law enforcement and accountability? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Phil, have you seen departments around the country, or maybe even other countries if you look that far, that you think are taking good steps towards some of the changes you're looking for when it comes to police culture?
Well, yeah, I think in some respects we're starting to see some agencies rethink some of their core functions. I don't know that it's a good idea to remove the role of traffic enforcement, traffic stops away from sworn officers. I worry a lot about that. I worry that there'll be a horrific incident where a city employee not carrying any weapons is making a traffic stop. You know, that's been proposed in some places across the country. And the first time, you know, one of those personnel gets seriously injured or killed, I think will be the end of that experiment. I don't have the answer. But it's very difficult. I mean, there are variations within agencies as to how they socialize their officers and the culture within the agencies. But we do see some core elements that are seemingly systemic, that seemingly from agency to agency are very similar and have the same values.
Let's go back to our callers now. Dale is with us in Merrill. Dale, hello.
Yep. You got me still?
Yep. What did you want to bring up, Dale?
So I've been a law enforcement officer for 35 years, and I can tell you as a law enforcement officer, I evolved over those last 35 years. I'm in supervision now. And I always kind of tell people when I first started, I wasn't a very nice person because I saw the world very much black and white, right and wrong. And it took time to understand what law enforcement is, and is that we are human beings. We're not supermen. We have some skill sets, but our primary mission is to try to make the community safe for everybody. And on the side of my wall, when people walk out of my office, I'm a supervisor, I have the oath of office up there to remind them every day that you are sworn to faithfully and impartially do the job to the best of your ability. And I always speak to my officers, the person we're dealing with today that is antisocial, that has done something wrong, is a redeemable person that tomorrow could be our victim or could be our ally, our witness in another crime. And it's about, you got to deal with people's misconduct, you got to deal with accountability, but you always want to try to have that building of rapport when it's done and treat them like a decent human being, because you're going to see them again. And if they remember you as a person that treated them like a human being, it may not go as bad next time.
Dale, I'm really glad you called. I want to take you back 35 years ago or so, Dale. Is there something that you wish you had been either formally trained or just in the culture of the agency you worked at first, something you wish you'd heard then to make that journey, I don't know, faster for you?
Kind of what I've just said. I mean, so sure. Back then I started under revolver days, and back then It was a very much us versus them. There was this law enforcement is better than the person on the street, which is not the case. We're human beings. Every one of us is a flawed and imperfect person. And there always was this, and you still see it. And I deal with younger officers who are in the profession, trying to get them to see people as people. Now they're engaged in some pretty violent, sometimes very hostile actions towards you. But that's the 1% of their life. The 99% of their life, they generally aren't that way. And we only deal with people generally at their worst, not their best. I wish somebody would have, like I'm trying to do with young officers now, kind of turn on that light, because we can avoid bad things happening. It's a lot easier for everybody. It's just a better system.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Dale. Phil, what do you think?
Well, I thank Dale for his comments. I agree with what he said. I think the question is, how do we get those young officers to the point of enlightenment, if you will, so that they perhaps calm down a bit, so that they see people that they interact with as individual persons, not really in an us versus them mentality. And I think that's a big question going forward. How do we get how do we socialize the officers? How do we train them? What kind of people do we want to become police officers? Because one of the things, you know, I track almost 300 variables for every case in my research where we have officers who've been arrested. We have over 18,000 cases of officers being arrested for any type of crime imaginable since 2005. And one of those 300 or so variables is years of service at time of arrest. And we do see some patterns and some very distinct changes in terms of the types of behaviors that we see based on years of service. So I think Dale raises some interesting points. On the flip side to that, by the way, Dale, be careful. We also see late in career that sometimes officers become very, very cynical, and that can lead to different types of poor behavioral choices by police officers. So we're constantly looking at that as well, so that we can help officers later in their career stay on track and transition to retirement easier, because some officers late in their career have difficulties with sort of planning for that transition.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go next to Ross in Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Bill. 60-year-old guy. I spent some time in the military, so I kind of get the warrior concept, but I ended up in healthcare. And the question that I have, when I talk about these kind of issues with my colleagues and friends or whatever, there's sort of this expectation of some people to say, if a policeman shows up, you automatically sort of do what they say. You sort of, you follow what they're saying. You follow their orders and be a good citizen. But it seems to me like what human nature is, and the police will show up when an individual is already revved up, and it seems to me, instead of trying to, like in a mental health situation, talk this person down, they immediately sort of play hardball and expect this individual to just somehow, through a miracle, to just automatically calm down. And it seems like in Jacob Blake and Kenosha and George Floyd, and I'm sure others, it just seems like there's this expectation of the ultimate victim to have calmed down when it's against human nature.
Ross, thanks for the call. So that expectation of compliance, Phil, when somebody's in the midst of maybe a mental health crisis.
Yeah, so the whole idea of recognizing what the individual's status is, but then also de-escalation. And some officers are better than others at de-escalation, but that's one area we have seen a lot of movement on in the last 5 years or so, with the renewed emphasis on de-escalation training, is in-service training for officers, where officers really need to develop better strategies at how to calm the situation down, de-escalate situations, as opposed to escalating situations. Because sometimes what we see in these cases is that officers arrive on the scene, and as Ross was alluding to, they immediately escalate the situation. So somebody who's already, as Ross said, ramped up is not going to respond well to that. And we need to really look at a lot of this as how to treat people who are in mental health crises. And a lot of places, police officers do a good job of that, but in many other places, they do a poor job of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Phil, that's all the time we have. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, as always.
We've been talking to Philip Stinson, professor in the criminal justice program at the Department of Human Services at Bowling Green State University. He's a former police officer and attorney. He created one of the country's most comprehensive data sets on police misconduct. He joined us today to talk about the code of silence that police allegedly provide colleagues accused of wrongdoing and why it's not necessarily happening that way during the Derek Chauvin trial going on now in Minneapolis. Coming up after the news, as more people become fully vaccinated, we look at what's in store for tourism here in Wisconsin and around the country. And you can get a head start on that conversation. Let us know if you want to travel. Where do you want to go? What is it going to take to make you feel safe going there? And if you work in a business that relies on tourism, what are you doing to try to make sure that you have a safe and welcoming experience to travelers who may be a little nervous about it? Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, a theoretical physicist shares some of the weirdest mysteries of the universe and makes the case that more people, including women and people of color, should have access to the world of science. Meet the author of the new book, Disordered Cosmos, tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gave the official go-ahead for fully vaccinated people to travel within the U.S., but the agency still recommends that people hold off on all non-essential travel while the pandemic continues. National and international travel have seen massive declines in the last year. From the beginning of March until the end of 2020, industry experts say the travel economy lost about $1.6 billion each day. People in the business are hoping to see leisure travel rebound this year. What it's going to look like? Still an open question. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you fully vaccinated and planning to do some traveling, maybe soon? Are you limiting your travels, maybe just to emergency situations? Where are you dreaming of going when it's safe? And what does safe mean to you? And if you work in a travel-related business, love to hear your experience as well. At 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Betsy Pudliner is an associate professor in the School of Hospitality Leadership at UW-Stout. She's worked in the tourism industry for more than 30 years. Her areas of expertise include marketing and consumer behavior. Betsy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I appreciate it.
Well, I threw out a couple numbers there about how travel was hit. Can you give us more perspective on that? How How much were travel businesses hurt by the pandemic over the last year?
Well, let's take a look at pre-pandemic levels first. The USA had basically 11% of the total workforce. That's direct and indirect. Our economic impact in 2019 was $2.6 trillion. In 2020, our travel spending lost 42% overall, which was a drop to $679 million. Domestic travel lost 34%. Our international travel lost 76%. As you said, that equates to 1.6 million trillion lost daily in 2020. But more importantly, we lost $64 billion to federal, state, and local tax revenue since March 1st. On a state level, we lost 34%. Federal, we lost 37%. And local, we lost 26%. Unemployment, we're at 13.5% right now, second to behind the gas, petroleum, and shale industries. And we basically, we're gaining, though, back. If we look at Wisconsin particularly, 202,000 jobs were in Wisconsin in hospitality and tourism in 2019. We went down, of course, and we are back up now. We just gained 280,000 jobs in March alone. Food and beverage saw the largest increase to 176,000, where accommodations gained 40,000. But we're still down 18.5% in Wisconsin.
How did businesses try to cope with that? What kind of strategies did you see from businesses that rely on tourism to try to keep at least some of their hopes going and to be able to recover in the future?
Well, I'm really proud, especially looking at Menominee here. Our community support was outstanding. And that's what we really needed here in Menominee, as well as Wisconsin and across the United States, is that people took the time to say, look, we need to support these businesses. Let's get out there and help them as much as possible. Restaurants here in town set out outdoor dining during the summer months. They had curbside pickup. There's other initiatives across the state to help with other aspects like beverage. So they really it was a community effort on all our parts.
Now we have people getting vaccinated. The CDC says, okay, you can travel, but maybe hold off. So what are travel businesses looking at now that people are maybe getting ready to go back and visit again?
Well, they think there are going to be more people traveling by car instead of by airlines, but the airlines are picking up. We want to be people to be vaccinated, but it comes down to the masks and making sure that we're safe for everyone. So they're excited to return. Over half of the American travelers pulled by U.S. Travel are excited to return to traveling. I know we're all itching to get out and about to see family and friends. We want to resume past travel habits, like we planned vacations that we had for 2020. We put them off. We moved them to this year. And we're starting to see an uptick in the number of people traveling. Health and safety measures are still the most, basically what people are still concerned about are health and safety, or the main concern of consumers.
We're talking about travel and tourism and what it's going to look like maybe as soon as this summer, as more people get vaccinated. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you change travel plans, put them on hold? What are you looking forward to doing when it's safe? What is going to be safe enough for you? If you work in a business that is directly or indirectly dependent on tourism, tell us what things have been like for you, what your hopes are for the coming months. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Betsy Podliner is with us from UW Stout, associate professor there in the School of Hospitality Leadership. And Betsy, we heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page from Lisa, who writes that she plans to camp and explore in Wisconsin and maybe Iowa. And that, I know, I've heard from a lot of people, anecdotally at least, Betsy, that a lot of people did more that kind of thing. Go to campgrounds, socially distanced outdoor type of activities. Did we see some bright spots in travel there?
No, that actually is on the uptick even more so. People are really looking for the rural and an authentic experience out into the grand spaces of our country. I know camping and RVing rentals as well as purchasing are up. So that's a good thing. So it's really the rural areas that are going to see a really nice uptick in that, in travel. Unfortunately, conventions and events and meetings are still going to be a hybrid situation, if not canceled and returned coming back in 2022 and 2023. Business is off for the most part in terms of travel. So we're really going to see that leisure area take off.
How dependent is Wisconsin on that kind of convention and business travel as opposed to, you know, I'm going on a vacation kind of travel?
Well, if we look at Milwaukee last year, they lost a great deal towards their businesses. I think that was 84% were canceled over the course of 2020, and they don't see an uptake in that until 2022, 2023. So that's a really loss to something like Milwaukee with their events.
Then when you look at a lot of the tourist destinations in the state, Wisconsin Dells, of course, pretty famous.
Oh, yeah.
The Door County, a lot of places in northern Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen at some of those different well-known tourist stops in Wisconsin?
Well, I was traveling over to Eau Claire last weekend, and I did see the one place along I-94, and the name skips ahead. And I did see everybody out golfing outside on the miniature golf course, as well as it looked like a full parking lot. So it looks like people are traveling and getting out there. I think it's going to be outside activities that are going to draw people. And do you have the space for those outdoor activities? As well as if we're going to use something like the Dells, I mean, the great spaces over at the Dells, but the indoor activities like at the Kalahari and other things, can you ensure that people are going to be safe as well as when we're in such a closed and confined space?
I know you've worked some internationally as well. What are you looking at when it comes to when people can get on a plane and cross national boundaries for their travel?
Well, unfortunately, hopefully soon, we are down internationally across the board globally, down 76% for travel to international destinations. The question is, again, everybody has their own laws and dictates and what they're doing for, you know, surviving the pandemic. So are we prepared to basically test before we go, test during, or come back and test and also quarantine? So that vaccination is going to be important for us to open our doors to get people coming in back into our country as well as going international.
We're talking to Betsy Podliner, associate professor in the School of Hospitality Leadership at UW-Stout. She's worked in the tourism industry for more than 30 years. Her areas of expertise include marketing and consumer behavior. We're looking at how the pandemic has reshaped the tourism and travel industry. And now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you figure out some ways to get out and about over the last year? Maybe with that camping or outdoor related tourism? What kind of travel plans have you had on hold? What are you looking forward to now? Are you fully vaccinated and feeling like you're ready to rock? And if you work at a tourist attraction, hotel, restaurant that counts on tourism, or in a community that really depends on tourism in general, what are you seeing there? What kind of preparations are there to have a successful and safe summer season? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Betsy Podliner. She's an associate professor in the School of Hospitality Leadership at UW-Stout. We're talking to her about where the travel industry stands and where it's going as the pandemic continues. And you could tell us about your travel plans, if you have any, at 800-642-1234. Are you fully vaccinated and making a plan to travel somewhere in the state or beyond? Are you holding off for a while? If so, until what? Do you work in travel and tourism in one way or another? What are you seeing? What are you hoping for this summer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hey there, friend. So my children are in winter sports, so they travel all over the Midwest for their sport. and it necessitates us staying overnight in a hotel. But because of COVID-19, nobody else could be in the swimming pool when we were there. And I didn't mind that so much. My wife and the three kids and I had the whole pool all to ourselves, and it was kind of nice.
I'm assuming that's an outdoor pool. I'm assuming that's last summer during the pandemic, Mark?
No, it was this winter.
Oh, okay. Mark, thanks a lot for calling in. So people who have been able to travel, Betsy, maybe had a little more elbow room, it sounds like.
Yeah, especially if we're outdoor. Indoor is going to be difficult for large places that have, you know, indoor activities like the Dells. You know, I was talking to my students this morning and, you know, working in this industry, they found it uncomfortable to explain to a guest, you know, when they work in this industry, if they come in and they need to put a mask on, they don't know how really to deal with something like this. They're uncomfortable in talking to people about that because there's such a division in this country with people wanting to wear masks and people not wanting to wear masks. And we were discussing that today in class. And so we were strategizing, well, how are you going to get people to wear masks, to follow recommendations, the CDC guidelines? So it's one of those things that are really challenging for this industry.
What have you seen from individual businesses and how they've tackled that sometimes very awkward issue?
I see people, some managers, some employees approaching, like if at Walmart or at other grocery stores here around town. Some approach them, some don't. They're given, you know, a lot of leeway. It's not consistent. It's not a cohesive movement here in Menominee. I think it's going to be up to every individual that they have to realize their responsibility. I know as myself being on the high risk level, I have to, you know, take care of myself. So that's how I approach it, that, okay, I'm going to wear a mask because I need to wear a mask. You know, I will protect others. That's my responsibility. And that goes in for travel as well. If I go for travel, and getting on an airplane. I'd like to go back to Pennsylvania and see my mom. She's in a nursing home back home and she's been on lockdown for a long time. But if I fly, I'm going to take care of myself. So that's what I think travelers are going to have to realize is, you know, think about yourself and also think about others.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mark. We'll go to Katie now in Sparta. Katie, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's in the works, Katie, for your travel?
We've been planning a motorcycle trip to Niagara Falls, and we were going to go to over to Marquette, over to Manitowoc and take the ferry across and then ride across Michigan and go into Canada and go to Niagara Falls and come back on the U.S. side. And the first year we planned to go, a friend dropped her bike and broke her ankle, so we couldn't go. We wanted to go last year while they had the border shut down, so we're hoping we can go this year. Because we're all getting a little older, and we got to do these trips while we still can. So we're kind of, last year we did not do a lot of riding just because of the social distancing. I'm a recently retired RN, so I dealt with it from the very beginning, and now I volunteer and give out COVID vaccines 2 days a week. So I'm ready for it to be over.
All right, Katie, thanks for giving those vaccines. Good luck. I hope you could pull off that trip this year, or if not, then next year. It is a fine ride. I've done it in a car, not a motorcycle, I'll be honest. But, Betsy, a lot of people, I think, in Katie's position, they've got this trip in mind, and they're not sure when they can actually, you know, make it a go for sure, waiting for borders to open, places to open up, things like that.
Right. And then what I would do is just check the websites for each government. I was looking on different governments like the UK since I spent time in Scotland. And there they've posted a lot of different information on the requirements of travel. So I would check with Canada's websites as well as, you know, the United States and what their requirements are. It changes day to day. Bookmark them and get that report out and see what they need to do. But I think it would be okay as long as you have the vaccine. And as long as you follow the dictates of the country you're going to, you know, we should be able to travel. But again, if we look at the statistics, 18% to, you know, is still closed globally. You know, countries are closed because of different restrictions. So we need to check websites for governments to make sure we can travel.
Thanks a lot for that call, Katie, and good luck. I hope you get to go. Betsy Pudliner is with us from UW-Stout with the School of Hospitality Leadership there. You could join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about travel and tourism and the travel and tourism industries. And we heard on the Ideas Network Facebook page, Brandy writes she'd like to do some traveling with her partner before their baby arrives. Both of them are vaccinated. She'd really like to go far enough that they have to fly because she loves plane rides. But Brandy says, not looking forward to seeing a lot of people, especially maskless people. She admits it's hard to not judge those groups, but it's something she needs to work on before traveling. And that gets back, Betsy, to what you were saying. When you travel, not everybody's going to necessarily observe the rules the way you do. I don't know, what kind of attitude can we take with us there?
Well, customer service is going to be really important over the next few years. If we don't see an uptick in travel until 2023 to pre-pandemic levels, I think we're going to have to work together on this. It's going to have to be an effort on all of our parts. Patience and that customer service for our industry is going to be really have to be injected a lot more into our day-to-day habits to ensure that needs are met. We have that responsibility. No more, you know, gather information, know before you go. Try to see all points of view, not just your own. We're on this together because that's the only way we're going to be able to get out of it if we work together.
We'll go to Darren now on the line in Green Bay. Darren, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
As somebody who was born in England, I wish there was more clarity of information about what the rules are. You can look on various websites and so forth. But when England had the breakout of the more contagious strains of COVID and Brits were prevented from coming here, now there seems to be a little bit of political tit for tat, and they're saying that Americans are not allowed in Britain or having a tougher time getting in. I'm just wondering, I have the global pass, and I'm just wondering if there is going to be something done with the vaccinations. I've had both shots, so have my parents in England, but and all the Pfizer ones, but I'm wondering if a vaccine card can be added to people's passports to facilitate getting around the world a bit easier.
Darren, thanks a lot for that call. A big question. I know we've talked about on the show, Betsy, the idea of proof of vaccine that could maybe free up travel a little sooner for some people. What kind of things are you hearing about that?
What I'm seeing is it's a good thing. A lot of countries are talking about it, including our own. But what my thoughts are is you have to ask some hard questions, though. Research that I've uncovered is people are concerned about privacy issues. That's a lot of data information that they're going to have to gather for that passport stamp or a card that you put in your passport. Identity theft could happen. What about our privacy laws? What if about a person who can't receive the vaccine due to medical reasons? Is there going to be problems with them traveling? I travel alone a lot. I have the vaccine. But, you know, what if I'm traveling alone and I have to be, you know, I'm denied entry because, you know, I have to quarantine and it cuts into my tour, you know, tour time with a group. Am I going to have to pay? Is that person that can't get the vaccine going to have to pay additional costs? Are there going to be additional restrictions imposed on them? Is it going to impede travels? Are they going to be discriminated against? Are they going to be segregated against? I think we're going to have to ask a lot more questions. But right now, we're given a card, I know at Mayo, for that we received the vaccine. Is that enough? So again, right now we're in a reactive mode. And I think our reactions have fallen short in terms of delivering on information. So I think a lot of hard questions still need to be asked concerning vaccine passports. But I mean, that if that card's good enough that I got from Mayo, I would gladly put it in my passport.
And that's all the time we have, Betsy. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Betsy Pudliner, associate professor in the School of Hospitality Leadership at UW-Stout. We talked to her about what's ahead for travel and tourism in Wisconsin and beyond. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Biden called a commission to look at possible changes and reforms to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll find out what's at stake, and you could join in with your thoughts. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Today is National Grilled Cheese Day here in these United States. The origins of this holiday are shrouded in mystery, but the best way to celebrate is actually pretty easy: eating some grilled cheese. Weirdly, I had grilled cheese for lunch even before I knew it was Grilled Cheese Day. It's pretty good. It's actually, this is kind of weird, leftover grilled cheese, which is not usually at the top of my leftover list. This is kind of a fancy one we did with one of those meal kits, and it had, you know, nice bread and like fresh mozzarella and these like fried up onions and a sauce. It was really good, and it held up pretty well as a leftover. So it was a good celebration. On social media, a lot of people are celebrating, sharing their grilled cheese recipes and just general love. Some of Wisconsin's popular custard serving restaurants have been in on the action. I saw a national food reviewer say the best grilled cheese in the U.S. is served in Wisconsin, so that's cool. And even the National Weather Service got in the game using the day to promote storm safety with cheese. This was tweeted by the National Weather Service Milwaukee office. Don't tempt feta. I'm going to have to explain these puns here, I think. When Munster storms strike, you get that one, have already a safe place so you and your family are good. All right, cheese puns, don't blame me. That's all the National Weather Service. It's cheese news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.